This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to UW-Madison's retiring tribal relations director about the progress he's worked toward on campus over the last 23 years, aiming to make the school a better place for Indigenous people. Now, a breakthrough in science on nuclear fusion may get us one step closer to using fusion as a power source, but it's still a long road ahead. Scientists with the U.S. Department of Energy's Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory announced yesterday that they had created a positive energy gain with nuclear fusion driven by lasers. Nuclear fusion powers the sun by combining hydrogen atoms into helium, releasing lots of energy. For decades, researchers have worked to harness that power as a reliable source of energy to power important things like your radio. U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm spoke at a press conference yesterday.
It's the first time it has ever been done in a laboratory, anywhere in the world. Simply put, this is one of the most impressive scientific feats of the 21st century. It strengthens our national security because it opens a new realm for maintaining a safe, secure, and effective nuclear deterrent in an age where we do not have nuclear testing. Ignition allows us to replicate for the first time certain conditions that are found only in the stars and the sun.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been following news about fusion energy over the decades and the science fiction related to it, what do you think about this new breakthrough? What questions do you have about this as an alternative, as a power source in the future? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephanie Deem is a professor of engineering at UW-Madison, specializing in fusion energy and experimental plasma physics. Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Before we get to this week's announcement, let's get some Fusion 101. What is happening with fusion? Why is it generating so much energy?
Oh, that's a great question. So at the heart of what fusion is combining two light nuclei to form one. And this process releases a ton of energy. And as was mentioned earlier, same process that fuels the sun and the stars. And when we talk about releasing a tremendous amount of energy, this kind of goes back to Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, which basically means that if you compare the weight to what is produced, to what you started with, there's a change in mass. We actually lose it, but you don't actually lose it. It's converted directly to energy, a lot of energy. If you want to get a fuel equivalency from fusion for your entire lifetime, it's powering your car, enough energy to power your car, your home, all your electronics. You just need the heavy forms of hydrogen found in two bathtubs full of water combined with a couple of laptop batteries. And that's a lot of energy.
It's been a long quest to get here.
Yeah.
What happened in, what did they announce yesterday exactly? Why is it such a big deal in the scientific world, as it seems to be?
Yeah, great question. This was the first time ever that we proved in the environment here on Earth that you could actually produce more energy from the fusion reactions than you put into the fuel. And that's amazing because that shows that we actually can harness the power of the sun and the stars here on Earth. And then next step, how do we translate it to generating electricity? But that's really what you have to show first. And we did it. And that's amazing.
Yeah, it's a long road to get to that energy. But let's talk about the road that got us here first. There have been a lot of efforts, a few different ways people have tried to make fusion work. Can you give us a kind of a short version of the efforts to get here?
Yeah, there's two main ways that we look at how do you create the conditions for fusion here on Earth. And I mentioned you're combining two light nuclei. Normally they want to repel because they're both positively charged. So you have to heat them up to 10 times hotter than the sun. And you have to hold on to them long enough to get them to fuse. So there's two ways we do that. What NIF did was they shot 192 lasers at this little tiny pellet of fuel and used the lasers to compress it to create those extreme conditions. What I work on is another form is creating magnetic bottles to hold that super hot fuel to get heated up to those temperatures.
And that second one, I believe, is called a tokamak, if I'm saying that right, a Russian acronym. And there's, I don't know, kind of a friendly race, I think, between the laser method and that magnetic tokamak method. What there's been some promise. Tokamak has, as I understand it, gotten some pretty good results, but not that net positive yet.
That's a great point. And I think this part gets missed a little bit in when we're communicating our results. So all of our experiments in magnetic diffusion have not been designed to create ignition yet. That's by design, because we're focusing on a couple of different things. Some experiments are looking at how do we get up to the super hot temperatures. Some are looking at how do we hold on to these particles for that long. And we haven't combined all those concepts together. But we're actually building a device in the U.S. or by a U.S. company, and it should be up and running in 2025. That is the first magnetic confinement experiment based on a tokamak that can actually achieve ignition conditions. So I'm really excited about that. Yeah.
We're talking to Stephanie Deem from UW-Madison, professor of engineering, specialist in experimental plasma physics and fusion energy, looking at this big announcement from the Lawrence Livermore Labs, a positive gain in energy from a fusion experiment. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What are you curious about? What do you want to know? What's your reaction to this news? 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I had the pleasure of working at the University of Rochester's Laboratory for Laser Energetics, where we had at that time in 1978 to 1980, the world's largest 24-beam laser array. And it was a wonderful experience. Everyone that was working there at that time, and I'm sure today, is elated at this new discovery. And I just want to emphasize that it is going to require a massive, continuing, and dedicated investment in basic science, as well as in the experimental realm. It's not going to turn things around overnight, but this is truly a glimmer of hope, Tom, for the world.
Tom, thanks a lot for sharing that experience and your thoughts. Stephanie, what do you think?
I love that you brought that up. Yeah, because it really is that intersection of that deep fundamental understanding that sparks innovation that then translates to that transformative technology that works on the actually harnessing and generating electricity. And I also love that you worked at University of Rochester, because the first call I made after that press conference was to a couple of my colleagues, and one was calling from the University of Rochester, and she was so excited. And we were just on the phone, just like so excited about everything, because they're involved in a lot of this research as well, and collaborate with NIF too.
Tom, thanks so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Stephanie, one of the things that baffles me a little bit here is that we're dealing with plasma. Now, this isn't the plasma in our blood, but this state of matter, you know, like we've got solid, liquid, gas, and then plasma, which it has to be super hot to be plasma, and we don't have a lot of experience directly encountering it, which is good because it would be very painful. Yeah. There's a lot, if I understand correctly, that we don't know about how plasma operates and is going to behave.
Yeah, so that's one of the fascinating things that we find out, especially when we reach these high conditions. Because at the heart of what plasma is you actually heat things up so hot, you strip the electrons from the nuclei, so it's electrically charged gas. And how do you control that? And then what happens when you reach ignition? Because when you reach these super hot temperatures, you're actually merging nuclei together, and then it goes into self-heating itself. And then it just, because it's self-heating, it's self-sustaining, very interesting things happen. And so that's kind of why we ran into some initial problems, or, you know, we didn't fully understand what would happen when with these plasmas when we get to high enough temperatures. So now that we've reached these conditions, we can actually explore these plasmas that are self-heating, or we call them burning. And that gives us an understanding of how do you sustain them for longer for fusion power plant purposes.
Let's go back to our callers. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hi. I don't want to throw cold water on all this exciting information, but I'm just wondering what the negatives are. What kind of waste does this produce? And what happens if this information gets into the wrong hands, let's say the Russians or the Iranians?
Jacob, thanks for the call. Let's take that one step at a time, assuming we get to a point where we can do this at a scale where we're doing lots of fusion. Jacob wonders about waste products.
That is a great question, and I'm glad you brought it up, because we really need to mindfully think about this if we're going to be creating power plants. So the byproducts of the fusion process are helium, which is safe, and then you have a neutron, which actually carries a lot of energy, and we use that kinetic energy, we transform it into generating steam and turning turbines to generate electricity. It also can make some low-level radioactive waste. And so really what we're working on now that we've achieved these fusion conditions is doing that accompanying research to look at how can we develop materials that withstand the neutron damage and the high heat loads, and look on down the line of recycling them. So some of us are looking at how do you turn the recycling of those materials that are used in power plants, recycle them into new power plants, use them in new facilities in a safe manner. So yes, that is definitely something we're looking at and making sure we're mindful of.
And Jacob mentions the falling into wrong hands there. Now, I mentioned Energy Secretary Granholm earlier. She referred to, being able to talk about national security because we can't have nuclear testing of nuclear weapons. Fusion is used in, correct me if I'm wrong, in hydrogen bombs. There's a fission reaction that gives the energy to start a fusion reaction. We already know how to do that. So do the Russians, I believe. He's worried about misuse of this technology. Do you have thoughts on that?
That is definitely something that's very important to consider when you're developing any kind of technology. So I, in particular, really what drives me for magnetic confinement fusion is because you don't have to worry so much about misuse. But we do need to be careful of that, right? And so being mindful of that and looking at why are we creating this energy source too, and making it something that's useful and safe for as many people as possible.
Thanks for that call, Jacob. We're talking to fusion energy expert and UW-Madison engineering professor Stephanie Diem about a new breakthrough announced yesterday in nuclear fusion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a reaction to the news out this week? If you see the headlines and the news stories and you're still confused, I promise you're not alone. If you have questions, our guest can take a stab at answering them for you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Stephanie Diem, engineering professor at UW-Madison, about a breakthrough in nuclear fusion. For the first time ever, scientists proved ignition that got more energy out than what was put in to ignite it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about nuclear fusion? Are you excited about this breakthrough? Call in with your questions or thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Stephanie, we've got this laser thing that was announced this week. High temperatures there. The tokamak that you work at, high temperatures there. I've been doing this long enough to remember what looked briefly like breakthroughs in so-called cold fusion that didn't ultimately pan out over the years. What do we mean by that? Is that still an avenue that people are chasing?
Yeah, so I covered that actually in one of my classes, because that was a result that was reported. It wasn't physically possible. And it was reported without people accurately, checking results and making sure what they were measuring was actually products of the fusion process. So that's why it's really important to do peer review. And that was brought out in the meeting yesterday, and why when they got the results on December 5th, it took over a week to actually report it, because of that peer review process. Anytime when, like, some of the results they're talking about cold fusion, especially in the early 2000s, in ideal conditions, when they, do like simulations, it says, oh, maybe an ideal situation, you can get this process, but then the real world kicks in. And then temperatures suddenly have to get hotter for that process to happen for cold fusion. So that's why that's not really possible. Yeah.
And I think that primed some people to be skeptical about this week's announcement. Like, oh yeah, we've heard this before. This is a really different thing.
Yeah, this is definitely a lot of people working, you know, on decades of information. And really what made this possible too is that they saw difficulties previously in achieving these ignition conditions at NIF. And that really pushed researchers at Lawrence Livermore to understand the physics details and then incorporate these details into their modeling of what was going on, and then couple that with advanced measurement techniques. So then this modeling was used in turn to examine a wide range of possible operating scenarios and optimize the process, the manufacturing process, to really devise techniques to achieve these results. And so that's really what happened. You have this convergence of technology, modeling, instrumentation, feeding back on experiments, and finally getting, you know, achieving ignition. And that was amazing to see that perseverance happen and then pay off.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Josh is with us in Coloma. Hi, Josh.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Josh?
Yeah, I was curious what you thought the timeline would be for either switching entirely to this form of energy production, or if you see it kind of sharing in the load with some of the energy production processes that we already have, or if you see it taking over energy production in the U.S. someday.
Josh, thanks for the call. I think that's a question on a lot of people's minds. Stephanie, we're still in early days, but what kind of road could go from this announcement this week to, hey, we're producing a good amount of our energy from fusion?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. So now that we showed that we can actually achieve these ignition conditions here on Earth, comes what is the technology we need to do next to actually generate electricity? And that really comes down to looking at like three key things. Making sure that we're sustaining the conditions for fusion, and that comes with a little bit more experimental processes. The next, developing materials that can withstand these extreme fusion environments. And then the third is to develop the technology to generate electricity. That means around the fusion power plant, there'll actually be a blanket material. And developing that blanket material, because at the heart of what it does is it captures that neutron, slows it down, gets that energy to generate electricity, to turn the turbines, generate steam. And so that's what we need to tackle in the next, you know, decade. We're looking at a fusion pilot plant, possibly. That was one of the White House initiatives that kicked off earlier this year. And I was one of the speakers for that White House summit early this year. And then comes along with that, you mentioned the energy portfolio. I'm really an advocate of a broad green energy portfolio because I think what works for one community might not work for others. Solar, wind, thermal, they can work at great geographical locations that are ideal for those. Some of them are weather dependent, which is good for some locations, but some may want baseload power that's independent of, you know, external conditions, and fusion brings you that baseload power, and that's amazing.
Thanks again for that call. Talking to Stephanie Diem, engineering professor at UW-Madison, about this week's announcement of a big nuclear fusion breakthrough. Had a question from Brenda in Menominee who asks, what's the difference between a traditional nuclear power plant and one run by nuclear fusion?
Oh, great question. So when you think of like nuclear power plants today, that's based on the fission process. And that's where you have heavy, unstable isotopes fall apart, and that releases energy. And what fusion is combining two light nuclei together to form just one nuclei. What's great about fusion is the fuel for fusion is the most abundant element in our universe. It's hydrogen, or different heavier forms of hydrogen. So those are the two key differences.
Time for one more caller. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I've been around, anyway, I'm a potter, so I've been around pottery, stoneware, pottery kilns, which gets to be like 2400 degrees. But how do you contain the heat that you're talking about? What possible material could there be that would, you know, not melt? Or, I mean, we don't have anything at the moment that would withstand that.
Willem, I gotcha. The signal's not great, but a great question. We're working with high heats. How do we keep the hot side hot where we want it to
be? Yeah. That's a great question. That's what I work on is magnetic fusion. So it works by getting basically making magnetic fields to push that hot fuel off the walls. Now, I mean, you're going to get some interaction at some point. It's not perfect. And it actually, we have kind of a heat exhaust for that reason. It's like a, just like your car. And we're looking at different kind of alloys that can be the best way to handle those high heat loads. A lot of them are based on tungsten, and we're going to be looking at more maybe alloys down the line. So now that we've created those ignition conditions and shown it's possible, now we're going to start funding more of that technology and the materials research needed to define those alloys and do that research.
Thanks for that call, Willem. In our last minute, Stephanie, as I look at all these technical details, it seems fussy as a layperson, unsolvable, but I've seen people point out, hey, it's a long road from oil burns to we're all driving internal combustion engines. Are these problems, do you think, solvable?
That's a great question. I mean, we can create the conditions here on Earth. We can, like, just looking at the NIF experiment, they can focus 192 laser beams at the and into, you know, a cylinder the size of a dime that then creates X-rays that implodes the fuel the size of a peppercorn. I mean, that is an amazing engineering challenge. And then similar on the magnetic side, we have these devices that are, you know, a couple stories big, built to millimeters precision. And we have these amazing engineering feats. It just takes time to tackle these challenges and funding for innovative research.
Stephanie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Stephanie Diem, UW-Madison Professor of Engineering, specializing in fusion energy and experimental plasma physics. She joins us today to talk about a breakthrough in nuclear fusion. You may have seen the headlines out there. Scientists at the U.S. Department of Energy's Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory announced the finding, the breakthrough, yesterday. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get some advice on making smart donations to charities during the December giving season. And as always, you can weigh in with your questions, maybe your experiences. You can start now. How do you decide who to give to? If you're with a group that needs donations, let us know about it. Ideas@WPR.org is the email. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Net. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after a 2016 study was canceled because of a high number of adverse side effects, researchers appear to be on track to develop the first male birth control on the market. A science journalist shares the latest research. Now, UW-Madison's relationship with Indigenous cultures and students has made some progress over the last few decades with new programs like the Our Shared Future Initiative and other collaborations with Wisconsin tribes. One of the people at the center of many of these efforts is retiring at the end of the year and leaving behind a legacy of bringing Indigenous communities together on the Madison campus. Aaron Bird Bear first started working at UW in the year 2000 and became the school's first tribal relations director in 2019. He's retiring January 1st. I talked to him earlier today. Now, you were born, I understand, in New Hampshire. You're enrolled in the three affiliated tribes of the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota. What originally brought you to Wisconsin and to UW-Madison?
There are three groups in the United States that tend to be highly itinerant: the military, the clergy, and academics. And one of my friends that I knew at the University of Washington, Seattle, became a faculty member in the Department of History here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And that faculty member remembered that I worked with Indigenous youth in STEM kind of pre-college programs at the University of Washington and recommended I apply and come to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And thankfully, I was hired. Back in the year 2000, and I came to UW-Madison to help strengthen the Native American student community in particular in partnership with a history faculty.
Now, when you looked at that community and what kind of things were available here at UW-Madison, what struck you about what was and wasn't available?
Well, there wasn't a strong kind of acknowledgement of the indigeneity of the space itself. There were Native American student groups that had been active since the 1960s, late 60s, early 70s. So there was a Indigenous student presence. And there was also the American Indian Studies program, which offered numerous courses and different types of academic programming, such as the storytelling festival, where they invite Indigenous speakers of their languages to share parts of their culture during the wintertime. And so, but beyond that, there wasn't a lot of real visible kind of Native American presence at the institution, which I found surprising because I'd just come from the University of Washington, Seattle a few years prior, which is one of the leading Research One universities in the United States for engaging Native nations and representing Native American cultures on the campus.
Now, you had this tribal relations director job that was recently created. In a lot of ways, you've been doing that job since you got here. Could you talk about some of the things that you helped establish to fix those absences you saw here?
So I kind of think about the incredible Native American campus community of faculty, staff, and students, and everybody had been chipping in some way to help fulfill the absence of a tribal relations director role or tribal liaison role at this institution. I think back to like the 2008 diversity forum, one of the first diversity forums held on campus, and they wanted the Ho-Chunk Nation to participate, particularly the president of the Ho-Chunk Nation. And they asked people like myself, then a student services coordinator, to arrange the president's participation at these major conferences. Also, you know, the university in designing Day-Job Residence Hall, I was then an assistant dean in the School of Education. They asked me to help facilitate parts of that process as well for kind of the interior design components of Day-Job Hall. So, you know, although we already have full-time jobs on campus, you know, various parts of campus would reach out to us, indigenous faculty, staff, and student community members, and ask us to help with different kind of projects that intersected with indigenous nations in some way.
And one thing that's involved, I understand, is taking, at this point, hundreds or maybe even thousands of people on tours around campus. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, back in 2003, we created the First Nations Cultural Landscape Tour as a retention vehicle for Native American students at the institution. There's all used to be significant first-year retention challenges for American Indian students, and this tour was designed to highlight how special of a place this is. And so beginning in 2003, we started offering these types of tours. When I went to work in the School of Education in 2008, it became apparent that this tour was also very useful for our pre-service students, pre-service teachers in the teacher education program to help them fulfill the Act 31 mandate to teach the history, culture, and tribal sovereignty of the Native Nations of Wisconsin at least twice in elementary and at least once in high school. And so we found this tour suddenly had utility beyond just helping Native American students orient themselves to campus. It offered a type of learning, a place-based experiential learning that people found valuable. And so over the years, yeah, we've offered many tours. In the height of pre-pandemic, my colleague Omar Poehler, who's the Indigenous Education Coordinator in the Office of the Provost here at UW-Madison, Omar Poehler and I offered 128 tours in the 2018-2019 academic year. And we don't offer tours when it's cold, so they're kind of crammed into the beginning of the semester.
And now, 2019, you became UW-Madison's first ever Tribal Relations Director. What has that role meant to you?
Well, it's an emerging role in higher education. We're not the first by any means to establish this type of position. University of Washington, Seattle, I mentioned, has had a position similar to this for a long period of time and started engaging in long-term relationships through memorandum of understanding with the tribal nations of the state of Washington back in the late 90s. So some universities have like a 20-year head start on us in thinking about long-term relationships with Native nations. There are approximately 30 tribal relations, tribal liaison staff across the United States today, with one of the preeminent staff being at the University of Arizona, Dr. Karen Francis Begay, and the role she's done from taking Native American student services and expanding it to these high-level consultancy or guidance positions for university leadership. And so her dissertation just came out this year on the tribal liaison, tribal relations role. And so it's nice to see the University of Wisconsin-Madison better fulfill the Wisconsin idea by liaising with governments in the way it liaises with other governments, say city, state, local governments. We've had a director of federal relations for a long time, a director of state relations, a director of community relations, a director of corporate relations that's now called the Office of Business Engagement. But for whatever reason, there was this kind of lack of understanding of to engage the 12 governments of the Native Nations of Wisconsin, we should have a similar position to fulfill the Wisconsin idea. And so it's really happy to see the university finally understand if it wants to fulfill the Wisconsin idea for all citizens within the state, it needed to have a director of tribal relations to liaise with the tribal governments of the state in the same ways that it liaises with city, state, and federal governments.
Now, as you leave this position and your long time at UW-Madison, if I may ask, what's next for you?
Retirement. That's the exciting part. You know, I've had a lot of pursuits over the years, and one that gave me a lot of spiritual nourishment was snowboarding. I was a skateboarder in the 70s in Colorado and a snowboarder in the 90s and 2000s, both in Colorado here in Wisconsin. And with my knees finally having had three knee surgeries from all my love of snowboarding, surfing is the next board sport that kind of is on my horizon. And I had the fortune of getting to surf in March in Hawaii this year. And Pop's break, popular break off of Waikiki, a very kind break. And it's a little far out. It's about, you know, 400, 500-yard paddle off the shore. But when I got there, it was a bunch of 60 and 70-year-old men and a group of young women from Japan. So I knew I was in the bright, bright break, a kind break, a friendly break. And seeing those gentlemen out there, I was like, okay, I want to be you. You're the people I want to become in my retirement life. And so I just really look to pursuing surfing as much as I can.
Well, happy surfing to you, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, and just a reminder, surfing is an indigenous tradition mm-hmm. given to us by the Kingdom of Hawaii and the indigenous inhabitants of that island. And so all these sports, you know, skateboarding, snowboarding, are all derived from the indigenous tradition of surfing. And surfing just keeps you connected to the world, living world around us, and allows us to really enjoy nature in ways that we might not otherwise. And so I'm thankful that these indigenous traditions keep nourishing my spirit as well.
Aaron Bird Bear is the Tribal Relations Director at UW-Madison for another few weeks. He retires at the end of this year. With us today, looking back on his two decades on campus, the progress he's seen over that time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a writer's own food tradition.
Food can conjure up vivid memories of childhood. The tastes and smells can send us to another place while creating new memories in the moment. That's why writer Nancy Jorgensen has been thinking a lot about her German heritage and being raised on raw foods.
My cousins and I spit the last of our watermelon seeds into Nana's lawn and tumbled into the house. I was 10 years old, or maybe 6 or 12. In the kitchen, Nana leaned against the counter. She stroked my cheek with one hand and held a plate in the other, slaughtered beef, freshly ground and bloody red. Our parents circled an oak table. My uncles clutched Gettleman or Old Milwaukee and blew cigarette smoke. On the stove, pickles boiled in vinegar. The smoke and steam made my breath catch. Mother got up from the table, and in a few seconds, a knife rested in her hand. In front of her, a loaf of rye. On the counter, a shaker of salt. "Would you like some raw beef and onions?" I put out my hand. I was raised on this traditional German food, along with kraut from Nana's stoneware crock and sausage from her hand-cranked meat grinder, oozed into animal intestine casings. We rarely ate in restaurants, our parents and grandparents creating meals from hand-tilled gardens, ancient grapevines, or a neighbor's Holstein. Now, my family often eats in restaurants. Last month, my husband Joel and I spent a week in Portland with our adult daughter, Gwen. One night in a local pub, she considered appetizers. On the menu, steak tartare. With a new name and extra ingredients, uncooked egg and capers, it was still Nana's raw beef and onions. We cook at home, too, and last week, our older daughter Elizabeth prepared dinner for us. While we sipped Shiraz, she presented a tenderloin, crisp on the edges, but red and bleeding from the middle, just a few degrees past rare. Each bite, dipped in horseradish, stung my nose with a prickly ache. It took me back to Nana's garden, where that gnarly root grew among her beets and kohlrabi and turnips. I savored the burn. As Nana peeled carrots or cooked a warm potato salad dressing, she told me I was German and Pennsylvania Dutch. Her pride, like her red-checked tablecloth, underpinned every meal. It was clear my daughters inherited her German pedigree and taste for hearty dishes. A while back, Gwen, Elizabeth, Joel, and I spent 5 minutes spitting into tubes. When the results came back, Nana's genetics weren't as strong as I believed. My German DNA is less than 33%. I'm also 11% Scandinavian and 13% British. And Nana never mentioned over pork chops that I'm 8% Ashkenazi Jewish. I wonder what those ancestors would say about our habits with uncooked meat and milk from the neighbor's cow. Before the holidays this year, we planned our Christmas menu. Gwen chose pickled herring, popular with German fishermen. Elizabeth requested pretzels, a German baking tradition. And I made German apple pie. But then I whipped a pint of cream, a British birthright, and dropped meatballs in gravy, definitely Danish. We included a Mediterranean salad, Asian egg rolls, and southern pecan pie. Surveying the dishes, I realized our German heritage a muted presence. But our Wisconsin ties shouted. Piper porch wine, raised grain beer, Wisconsin-produced milk. From our own garden, pickled cucumbers, heirloom tomatoes, Duchess apples. A bounty of food and tradition, as wide as the world and as narrow as Wisconsin.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer based in Waukesha, and her story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a science journalist brings us up to date on the latest research on male birth control. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, when you hear the phrase male birth control, you might remember some years back, 2016, it was a study that was canceled at the time some in the media declared that men can't handle side effects that women face daily. That didn't get it quite right. The study was cut short because a lot of men showed significant adverse side effects. Since that 2016 study, though, and before it, researchers have been working to try to develop a male contraceptive. Now they may be closer than ever with a promising new candidate in development. Eleanor Cummins is a science journalist and adjunct assistant professor at New York University's Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program. She wrote a recent piece for STAT about the quest for male contraception. Eleanor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as you write, that 2016 announcement that a study had been cut short, the way it was reported on the media, I don't know, it seemed like to close the door on male contraception, the idea that, hey, men won't want to deal with side effects, so why bother? Talk about how that didn't get it quite right.
Yeah, absolutely. So the World Health Organization had undertaken a study for a male hormonal contraceptive with a very long name. But the basic premise is the same as 50 years of research in this field, which is how can we sort of manipulate the sort of male, hormonal and endocrine system in order to disrupt sperm production and therefore prevent pregnancy. The World Health Organization went through a trial to look at one possible way of doing this. And what they found was that it was pretty effective. On the whole, the participants in the trial really liked it. But some of them were having really serious emotional side effects, up to and including an individual who attempted suicide. And they decided, we need to sort of beg off here, right? Maybe these side effects are too serious. We don't exactly understand what's happening. And ultimately, we don't think it's worth it to continue this trial. So that gets picked up. It's, this whole narrative of men are wimps. They can't handle contraceptives, which women have been dealing with similar side effects, for decades. And it really felt like a nail in the coffin, according to a lot of male contraceptive researchers I spoke to. But fortunately, things are looking brighter once again.
Yeah, one of the most promising ones researchers are finding is, I think it's a long name drug. It's being called NES/T. What is it?
Yes, Neste. Neste is a combination of testosterone, which we all know, and another hormone called nesterone. This is a drug that is actually administered, at least in its current form, as a sort of liquid gel. So you take a pre-metered pump, almost as if you were, putting a little bit of hand sanitizer into your hand, and you apply it every day to your back. And so they're having a lot of success with this. While the phase two clinical trial is still underway, and so that data hasn't been, reported yet, researchers are saying that they're finding that this does seem to be extremely effective in preventing pregnancy. It seems to be safe, and it seems to be reversible, which we know because when couples have discontinued this trial, they've gone through a whole year on Neste alone as their sole birth control method. They've been able to come out the other side and have children. So things are looking pretty optimistic that maybe we have landed on a reversible hormonal male contraceptive, but there's a long way to go.
Yeah. One weird wild card you write about is, as you mentioned, testosterone is kind of the main thing people are using. It weirdly stops sperm production, apparently, except it does it really unpredictably, where one population might respond really well to it, another one, not so much.
Yes. So researchers have been, to my surprise, researching male contraceptives for almost as long as they've been researching female contraceptives. We have, research trials going back to the 1970s, so more than 50 years of sort of evidence looking at this. And when we started to focus on testosterone, we found it was, really effective from a contraceptive standpoint, because when you add more, as you said, to the male system, the brain responds by sort of breaking that link with the testes where testosterone is produced. And the result is that sort of testosterone levels, you know, within the body plummet, as does sperm production. So this is like a really powerful tool, right? And researchers started to begin to figure out how to manipulate that. But what they found was that it's not evenly sort of effective across populations. In one study, they found that while almost all Asian males responded in a given trial to this testosterone strategy, a lot of their Caucasian counterparts actually failed to reach the ideal sperm suppression stage. And that's when sperm levels drop low enough that we can say, more or less, at least while you're taking this drug, you are infertile. And so that has left us in this sort of weird circumstance where, you know, 100% of females who take female birth control are going to respond. What does it mean if only 97, 98% of males respond to contraceptives? We've never really faced a situation quite like that before.
Another interesting question you write about is, you know, when you're evaluating any medication, you're saying, okay, here are the side effects and risks. Do the benefits outweigh those risks? With a woman taking birth control, the risk you're looking at is unwanted pregnancy. Easy. For a guy, how do they measure, factor that risk in to balance it versus side effects?
Right. So I would say right now that no one really knows. We don't have like a well-developed sort of ethical, you know, construct to evaluate these pros and cons of a drug in someone who isn't going to be physically affected, at least by an unintended pregnancy or by a complicated pregnancy. So researchers are trying to fill that gap. Right now, we're seeing a lot of efforts to develop a model of what is being called shared risk. And so the idea is that, yes, maybe we haven't, you know, been able to sort of summarize, like, okay, here is what the male partner sort of risks with an unintended pregnancy. But that doesn't mean that there aren't side effects, right? Whether those are social, economic, or perhaps biological, more research is needed. And similarly, maybe like that doesn't matter, right? If two people decide to, you know, take on, you know, both the sort of pros and cons of sex, then that means that they also, you know, share that responsibility for the optimal outcome. So with a shared risk model, researchers are trying to sort of pave the way for saying, yes, maybe, you know, there are an increase in side effects from male contraceptives for men and no sort of risk of unintended pregnancy, but that's not good enough anymore, right? And we need sort of a model that looks at both partners as a unit.
We've talked a little bit about biology and ethics. Now, how about the economics? Is there a sense that, okay, we have a successful form of male birth control, people are going to buy it?
Right. So I think that there is a lot of optimism now that there is a sort of a consumer base for this, that there's definitely people who are ready and willing to take on this responsibility for male contraceptives. You know, in trials to date, the people we're seeing who are enrolling and saying like, yes, I'll be a guinea pig, test this on me, are often men whose female partners have sort of hit the end of the road in terms of what the available contraceptives are to them. So they've had bad reactions to, you know, everything from copper IUDs to hormonal pills. So they're saying, yeah, I want to take that on. It looks like, you know, we would have ultimately like more than half of men of sort of reproductive age in the U.S. ultimately sort of open to an idea of a hormonal contraceptive, which is great. But what we're seeing is that the investment, which typically would come from the pharmaceutical industry, isn't there yet. And that's going to be crucial for pushing this forward, both, you know, in collecting the research needed and actually taking it all the way to the Food and Drug Administration, to the FDA, and saying, you know, will you approve this for use?
Very briefly, in our just last quarter minute, is there a timeline when we might see something like this on the market?
I think that we're not going to see this for another decade, which is, you know, a little bit shocking because researchers have already been cranking on this for 15 years. But yeah, I would say that another decade seems like the sort of consensus right now, just in terms of what work is left to be done.
Eleanor, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eleanor Cummins is a science journalist. She wrote about male birth control research in the journal Stat. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's more than just punching supervillains. Superhero stories can have a political message. We'll hear more from the creators of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Universe. Plus, we'll get the latest on affordable housing issues around the state and evictions here in Wisconsin. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.